You have to choose a title in June, you know, for the Sundays in July. So you haven't yet worked on the text, but you're thinking, this is where I might go with it. Speaking the truth to power. I looked up on the internet this week to see where that phrase came from, because we hear it. I think you do. I do. And it came from the Quakers in the 1950s. When they started to see what President Eisenhower, on leaving office, talked about, the fact that the United States of America was being taken over by the military-industrial complex. And they wanted to talk about a new vision, a way forward that didn't involve armaments and power and war. And they called their mission Speaking Truth to Power. Now, because this is a government town, many of you may recognize the name of Arthur Kroger. He spent many, many years here as one of our top civil servants. He died recently, and an article about his funeral was in the newspaper, and it was entitled, Speaking Truth to Power. And this is an excerpt from it. It said, those readers who attended the funeral in Arthur Kroger's honor a few weeks ago will remember the thoughtful tributes of Gordon Osbaldiston, who spoke so passionately and affectionately about his former colleague. In many ways, it says, both of these gentlemen who joined the federal public service in the mid-1950s represent the old public service that is remembered by many as a golden age, where working in government was seen as a calling very similar to joining a religious order. And looking back on their 40-year careers, Osbaldiston spoke of Kroger's professionalism and his commitment to excellence. However, it was his recollection about Kroger's special role as a policy advisor that helped define his more than 17 years as a deputy minister. Osbaldiston reminded the audience that the notion of speaking truth to power always anchored Kroger's work. He said that it was typical of the civil servants who sought to provide unvarnished and truthful advice to ministers and collectively to the government of the day. And that was interesting because only a few days later there was an article in the newspaper talking about backbenchers and how collectively they are afraid to speak out, to speak truth to power, because they'll never move to the front bench if they do. Also in the news this very week was an example of what happens when we fail to speak truth to power. It was an American story, but because it involved the University of Pennsylvania and their vaunted football team, it even made the news in Canada and across the world. A few weeks ago, an assistant to Joe Paterno, the famous football coach, was convicted of sexually abusing scores of young boys over many years. And the investigative report revealed that several people were aware of this. Janitors, in fact, witnessed that they had seen it. And they were afraid to report it because, as they said, they feared losing their jobs. And people at the top, they cared more about the school's reputation and the donations of the alumni than what would be the effect on these young boys for the rest of their life. Speaking the truth, especially speaking the truth to powerful people and interests, is a risky business. And our readings for today are very clear about that reality. It's the priest Amaziah. He's one of the religious leaders who orders Amos the prophet to get out and go home and shut up. We don't need your prophesying here. And Amos replies that this was not something that he set out to do, to be a prophet. He was, he said, a shepherd. But the Lord took me from looking after sheep, and he said, go prophesy to my people Israel. Now, when Martin Luther King went to talk on one occasion to a group of some sanitation workers in Memphis, a lot of people told him this is something that he shouldn't do. And he said, I can't not do this. I think that Amos felt exactly the same way. He was compelled to speak the truth that God had put on his heart. Now, when it came to Jesus' cousin John the Baptist, he had apparently no fear of telling the truth, and telling the truth so strongly that he was willing to risk paying an awful price for doing so, and that is what has landed him in jail. Now, the reading from Mark is a kind of aside. It interrupts the flow of the narrative. If we left this story out and we went from the verses that we read last week to the verses that come after, there wouldn't be any break in the narrative at all. In the midst of the stories about Jesus' ministry and that of his disciples, of which we heard last Sunday, we are brought up to speed on what has happened to John. We last saw him in the very first chapter of Mark. He was the wild prophet, dressed funny, eating funny, baptizing people in preparation for the coming of the one that he described as more powerful than I. And then Mark writes, still in the first chapter, that John was arrested and put in prison. And that's all that we hear about John until today's reading. Our story begins with Herod hearing about Jesus and his disciples, about their casting out of demons, about their healing the sick. Now, this Herod is Herod Antipas. He is the son of the infamous Herod the Great, a man who was profoundly paranoid and murderous. Now, this Herod, I think a little less of a tyrant than his father, was like him in that he was primarily concerned with using power for his own pleasure and getting what he wanted. And it seems that one of the things that he wanted was his brother's wife. So Herod dispensed with his own wife, and Herodias divorced Philip, and they married. And we have no record of the confrontation between John and Herod, or Herod and Herodias. But he did confront him, and we know, and he let Herod know, that what he and Herodias had done was wrong, both morally and according to Jewish law. Now, Mark tells us that Herodias nursed a grudge, and she wanted to kill John. So I thought it was kind of curious when I read, but she was not able to, because Herod feared John, and he protected him. So locking John up kind of sounds a little bit like protective custody, right? In prison, Herodias's minions would not be able to get at him and kill him as she wished. We also learned from Mark that Herod liked to listen to John. He was intrigued, and he recognized him to be a righteous and a holy man, the text says. There's something compelling about John, his strange habits and his harsh message. Herod was puzzled, and he probably couldn't say that he understood a great deal of what John was saying, but he liked to listen. And then came the fateful day when, to celebrate his birthday, Herod threw a huge bash for his high officials, military commanders, and the leading men of Galilee. And as you know, as you heard, part of the entertainment during the feast was a dance by the daughter of Herodias, his stepdaughter. Now, Herodias may have been surprised by her good luck. We don't know if the dance was her idea or was simply a convenient opportunity. Either way, she was ready. We all know what happened next. So taken up with Herod, with the dancing, and addled by wine and lust, that he promised his stepdaughter anything at all that she wanted, even up to half his kingdom, which is pretty crazy because he couldn't have given away half his kingdom. It wasn't his to give, so at any rate, you can see how rash he was. And she was young, so she went to ask her mother, who now, of course, saw her chance. I want you to give me the head of John the Baptist on a platter. No mere execution would do, because it has to be one designed to humiliate John, even in his death. Herod is greatly distressed, writes Mark. He had listened to John. He had really listened, even though his words were hard to hear. And knowing that John was righteous and holy, he knew, somehow he knew, that John spoke the truth. Perhaps he had known at some level that John's words, disturbing and condemning as they were, held some hope of salvation for him. As a preacher, Janet Sonnenberg wrote in a sermon that I read online, "There is more than one dance going on in this story. There is also Herod's flirting dance with the truth. The truth about morality, the truth about sin, and the truth above all about himself. He flirts with that truth, not letting it get too close, not letting it really touch him and change him, but keeping it near enough so that he could listen. Any kind of getting close requires that we reveal ourselves. But getting close to the truth, that reveals us to ourselves. And that can be upsetting, as it clearly would have been for Herod. Still, somehow he doesn't want the voice silenced completely and forever. He wanted, if nothing else, the chance to keep on listening. And then came his stepdaughter with her request, her mother's demand, and he didn't want to do it. That's why he's conflicted. But as Mark says, because of his oaths and because of the guests, he made his choice. Off with John's head. I always like to ask myself when looking at these gospel stories, where am I in these stories? As painful as it is to admit, some of us are like Herod in many respects. I think we do our own tentative flirting dance with the truth. We want enough of it to shed some light, to emotionally move us even. But we don't want it close enough to actually change us in any real or lasting way. If we think about our encounters with the gospel, think of the times you have heard Jesus' words in sermons, here and other places, in your own reading perhaps. Listening to Jesus often perplexes us, yet we like to listen. Sometimes he says things that make us angry, things that challenge the choices we make and the priorities that we have chosen for our lives. Yet we admit that we find him compelling, even if we only listen to him on Sundays. But even so, he draws us in, and we know that his message is something that we need to hear. It has a way of evoking the knowledge we are not as we should be. The gospel is bad news before it's good news, says Frederick Buechner in his book, Telling the Truth. The truth is that it shows us that we are not as beautiful in the deepest sense of the word as we like to believe. We are not always as good and as kind and as forgiving and as generous as we'd like to be. The truth of the gospel tells strips us of our pretenses and our illusions that we have about ourselves. And what do we do with this truth? For some, we start thinking, what might this mean for my life? For how I choose, for how I relate, for how I am. It gets uncomfortable, it gets too close. And we step back and we begin to move away. We change the subject. We close the book or we think about something else, something more pressing, something more practical, something more necessary. Some see that Mark has incorporated this story of Herod and the dancing girl to point out the cost of discipleship. What could it mean if you follow Jesus wholeheartedly? Some see, perhaps though, his intention is also to point out the costliness that covers not just those who follow, but all those others who, whether benignly or violently, fall short of really listening and responding to the truth of God's word. Becoming increasingly the prisoner, then, of our own habits and thinking and bent on preserving the self that we are, we're not free, to be all that God has called us to be. We're not free to forget about saving faith, about saving ourselves, and doing the right thing for God's sake. Perhaps that's also what Mark means to tell us. There's a cost to speaking up, and there's a cost, as we heard in our stories, there's a cost of staying quiet. There's a cost of not following, of not responding to the truth. So where is the good news in this story? As I have said before, I was taught in homiletics, the preaching course, that you always have to end with good news. You failed as a preacher if there's no good news for every Sunday morning. And if we take this story on its own, we would have a story of the way the world is. Mark is a realist, you see. What can we expect from the world but good intentions gone bad? Fearless truthfulness rewarded with imprisonment. And the triumph of the powerful over the powerless. And so it goes, on and on. You know, Mark is a realist. He is writing after the devastation caused by the Roman armies exercising their brutal power and destroying Israel and the temple. This story, as he tells it, is the world he lives in, the world that he knows, and the world that we live in as well, as we are reminded daily by the news. But, and this is a very important but, it is not the whole story. It's not Mark's whole story. It's not the gospel's whole story. It's not the end of God's story. Because Jesus comes, you see, precisely to show us that there is something more. There is something beyond the heartache and the intrigue and the tragedy of Herod and of all the other leaders who are willing to sacrifice their principles for political and personal gain. And the heartache and the intrigue and the tragedy of our own lives. So we come, as the Lutheran commentator David Lowes writes, to the very heart of the gospel promise. We believe, teach, and confess that Jesus came to make it possible for us to be more than, make it possible for us for more than mere survival, more than mere persistence, even more than success. Jesus came to help us imagine that there is more to this life than we can possibly perceive. He came to offer us not just more life, but what he referred to as abundant life. Jesus came so that there could be a better ending to our own stories and to the story of the world that we could possibly imagine or construct on our own. And when the temple has just been destroyed, or when your marriage is ending, or you've lost your job, or you fear that your child will never speak to you again, there is a possibility of another ending, a good ending. And that's indeed not just good news, but the best news that you could possibly imagine. This morning's story is often interpreted as a prefiguring of what will happen to the faithful Jesus who dies, like John, for speaking truth to power. His message and his life were a threat to the status quo. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the peacemakers. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus' ministry, like John's, has very significant political implications. Proclaim a kingdom of mercy and peace and justice and grace, and there will be costs to pay. Now, this text began with the news of the releasing and healing activity of Jesus and his disciples. And Herod knows that the effect that John had on him when he listened to him. And so he thinks that it must be John come back from the dead. We know, of course, that that's not true. And yet there's a little hint of what is to come in this story. The remarkable deeds do point to the resurrection. They point to the power of God already at work. But they do it not, they do it as a foretaste of what is to come and what will be. The resurrection, when it happens, won't turn John into Jesus. It won't turn Jesus into anyone else. But it will give Jesus himself a life and a kingdom beyond the power of Herod or Caesar. Beyond the power of any Herod or any Caesar that the world knows now. It will give him, in fact, all authority in heaven and on earth, which is how Matthew finishes his gospel. And that is the truth that we are invited to live into. That is the truth that strengthens our courage. That is the truth that gives us what it takes to speak truth to power. So I think this story does invite us to read on in the gospel, to read more thoughtfully, but also to examine the story of our own lives and that of the church today. Where are we called to stand out against wickedness? What threat will we face if we do? I find it very strange, for example, that we never talk in our churches very much about sex. Surely to goodness, as Christians, we have a different view from what we see all around us in the world. And yet we're silent on this. You know, even in this story, sex plays a role. If Herod wasn't lusting, I wonder if he would have demanded, if he would have been as careless with his promises. All sorts of things come to mind. Topics on which we have something to say, something of God's truth to share. And yet, somehow, we're shy. We're hesitant. In your life, what are the wrongs that you see? What are the things that you see that are not the way God wants them to be? Among your circle of friends, at work, at school, in our church, in our country, what is it that deep down you should speak out about and take a stand for the truth? You know, it's safe and it's easy to keep quiet while muttering to ourselves, as we often do, isn't it awful? But acting on the truth, no matter what, no matter what the cost might be. And then I have a word for all of us still dancing with the truth. Good at making excuses, continuing in our old ways. You know, there's good news for you too, for me too. Keep listening. Keep dancing. And my prayer is that we will dance a little closer. We'll hold on to what we hear a little longer. We'll open ourselves up more and more each time that we hear to the truth that challenges and changes us if we let it. It's a dance of incredible grace. Let's all join. Amen.